So we are missionaries to Papua New Guinea. I'll say PNG a lot, but that's an abbreviation for Papua New Guinea. So for those of you who don't know, that's where we have been for the last 3 years. And so, again, it's kind of hard to talk about it because, you know, when we went out before you, it's kind of like when you're young and dumb, right? Like, even though I was, you know, 37 when we left, or 36, whatever it was, you go out and you do a bunch of research online. You're like, okay, I think I know enough about this country. We can survive there. And then you go there and you realize every day, you're like, I really don't know that much. And even as we were leaving after being there 3 years, like, the more and more I realize, I still have much more to learn about the country. And so with that being said, it's easy to look at PNG from the outside and all you see is the bad, right? That's the only thing you're ever going to see in the news about Papua New Guinea is the bad things. But and honestly, that's probably a lot of what I'll talk about this morning, because we are back here in the States. We're here to itinerate. We're here to raise funds. We're here to present the need of Papua New Guinea to the people. But I just want you guys to know, I'm going to talk about the bad of the, but there's great people in Papua New Guinea too. The church there is growing. They have, I mean, some of the most dedicated pastors I've ever met in my entire life live in PNG and work in PNG. They're friends, they're our family, and, you know, we love them. So I just, as I go through some of this, I don't want people to think that we don't like PNG. We love PNG. We love the people of PNG. But I'm here to present the need. And so PNG is known as the land of the unexpected. So, and it's an apt name. You never really know what's going to happen while you're there, right? And if you do a little more research, you'll see some of the statistics of the land. So PNG has over 850 distinct languages in the country, with each one of those languages coming with a distinct people group. I didn't think that was possible till I got there, and you really don't even notice it when you're first there. But as you're there, you notice the different people groups, you notice different facial structures, and there really are 850 distinct languages, different people groups there. There's a lot of... There are a lot of similarities between them in different Melanesian cultures. I even see Auntie Sun in the back here. She's from Vanuatu. We were there before. You know, there's similarities between Vanuatu and PNG, but it's also a completely different place. And so it's certainly a distinct place. You might wonder, how would there possibly be a country who really just has the landmass of California and have 850 distinct languages? Well, a lot of the answer is geography. And so PNG has over 600 different islands all in one country. Now, there's only about 160 of them. They're inhabited. So that's 160 of the languages are like separated by water. But the majority of the languages are actually on the mainland of PNG. And so the mainland is the biggest, you know, the bulk of the place. But it's got mountains and rivers and things that just separate you, right? So there could be tribes that are only living a couple miles apart, but they're separated by a mountain range, and there's no reason for them to go across the mountain range, right? Why would you climb over a mountain just for the fun of it? I mean, we do that sometimes, but most people don't. You know? So there's, you know, separated by mountain ranges, separated by rivers, and even just a few days walk through the bush, you know, there's not infrastructure there connecting people. And so the road system is very poor. Even to this day, really, the majority of the road system is dirt roads. We live in the second biggest city in Papua New Guinea, and I cannot drive to the capital on a road. I have to get on a plane to fly or take a boat around the coast. So the road system's just not there connecting the people. And in that regard, sorry, I want to give a quick shout out to Speed the Light. I think Amy's got a picture of the Land Cruiser we got. And so when people see, I put this up there because people see Land Cruiser and they think of like the new, like super nice ones they have in the US. That's not what we got. And so we got a Land Cruiser. You know, these are known for being basically the most reliable vehicle in the world. There's a reason why you've seen missionaries in these trucks, and because they're almost indestructible. They're not really that fun to ride in. They're not comfortable. Don't get that great of gas mileage, but when you need to get in and out of somewhere, that's the truck for the entire world. And so there's no possible way we could have got that without Speed the Light. And so for those of you who don't know, Speed the Light is the branch of like the Assemblies of God, where the youth actually raise funds for vehicles for missionaries. And so without Speed the Light, there is no possible way we would have been able to get this vehicle. And, you know, I would hate to put a number on it, but, you know, 99% of the things we do in PNG, we could not have done without the Speed the Light vehicle. So thank you to Speed the Light and the youth of the Assemblies of God. Anyhow, so this makes it exceptionally difficult. The territory makes it exceptionally difficult to assess things in the country. And so there have been several attempts over the years to actually get numbers on how many people are in Papua New Guinea. And again, it's one of those things, until you're there, you don't realize how can the government not get a number. But it's just not possible to get some of these places. So the current estimates are somewhere between 9 and 16 million people that live in Papua New Guinea. And so a lot of what we did actually during these last few years is we were doing assessments around the country to see where the need was. Because obviously, as missionaries, we don't want to just, you know, put resources and things into places that don't need them. And so a lot of what our first trip was, or this last 3 years, has been assessing and doing, finding out what the need was. Again, it's a place of a lot of contradictions is what we found as we were going out there. So if any of you follow like the Joshua Project, you might see PNG and you wonder why it needs missionaries. So according to the Joshua Project, the country is 94% Christian. Even so much so that as in March of 2025, the parliament voted to officially make PNG a Christian nation, even putting references to God in the preamble in the constitution. The Bible is now recognized in PNG as a national symbol. Yet when we look at the reality of the country, it doesn't line up with that, right? Depending on what statistics you look at, PNG is one of the most violent countries in the world, as high as number two. You know, we're up there with Venezuela and all these countries where warlords are doing crazy stuff. We're in that range. So all kinds of violence, you know, violence against women, domestic violence, gangs, rioting, carjackings, human trafficking, just about every kind of violent crime you can think of, we're pretty high on the list, all right? And so how can that be in a country that's supposedly 94% Christian? Well, you know, I don't have all the answers, but let me give you my two cents. PNG suffers from a drastic lack of discipleship and knowing what it truly means to be a Christian. And just a quick example of something. So like one example we heard from some other people who had eventually become true Christians is they kind of thought they were Christians, and so but they have a very skewed view of the world. And so in one instance we heard where there were people who were doing carjackings on the highway, and they saw God bringing a car with like a lot of things that where they could get wealthy off it. They would carjack those people, and when they got the money from these people that they just robbed, that was a blessing from God, right? And so that's just a weird example of PNG and how sometimes your views can get a little skewed if you're not properly discipled. And so the vast majority of the people have heard the gospel in some form or fashion. Many of them absolutely would say they are Christians, but they were never truly discipled to understand what it meant to be a Christian. You know, many have a basic understanding of Jesus and who he is, but instead of truly understanding the gospel, they're turning to the one true God. They simply mixed Christianity in with animism. And again, these are things where, like, the longer you're there, the more it's hard to, we just glass over these things. I'm like, I really want to go into that a lot, but I can't. You know, we don't have 2 hours to explain animism and how it all just mixes together, though, right? So they heard about Jesus, the one true God. They hear all the stories in the Bible of all the things he did, and they just roll it in with their other religion. And so animists, just in a nutshell, they believe spirits exist all over the place. A lot of missionaries around the world right now, they're trying to convince people that the spiritual world exists. That's not the case in Papua New Guinea. Would they absolutely believe the spiritual world exists, and not only it exists, but it affects every part of our life. So they see spirits in everything. Everything that happens, it's caused by a spirit. And so, again, it takes a lot more to explain animism than that, but that's, you know, animism in a nutshell. And so even in places where we feel like it looks like discipleship has happened, things happen and their true color, you know, true colors come out. And so one example of this is actually the village where we stayed in when we first lived there. Now, this all happened shortly after we left the village. We weren't actually living in the village at the time, and we had moved to another town. But this village where we lived, there was an AOG church there, and there was a Catholic church not even that far down the way. So I don't know, you know, again, I can't put a number on it, but I would say pretty much 100% of the people in this village would say they were either Assemblies of God, they were Catholic, they would say they were Christians, right? And so one day, a couple of the, well, within a few days, it was like a week-long period, two people of influence in the community died. One of them died from cancer. We never actually met the guy. He was in the Capitol for years doing cancer treatment. The other guy died of, you know, it sounds bad to say that, but people just die in PNG and they don't know why. You know, there's all kinds of things they have there that we don't have here. And so anyway, two people died in the village that had some influence and in a place where we thought was a Christian community, and that animism starts to show itself. So what animistic tribes have traditionally done, and that's what they did, they will call someone called a Sunguma or Glassman or, you know, by, for our basic understanding, he's a witch doctor is what he is. And so they call this guy in, and he's supposed to discern the spirits and see what caused this to happen, because it can't be a natural thing. You know, people don't just die. Even they could be 100 years old and die, and they still think something caused it. And so these two people of influence in the community died, and instead of just mourning them, the community gets together, and they want to know why. And so they call the guy in. He comes, and what will typically happen with the glass man is they're going to point out one, two, three, whatever it ends up being, single young women, because they have very little status in the tribe, and he's going to say, they did it. They called the spirits. They caused this to happen. And what typically is going to happen is they're going to kill him. And so that's what was going to happen in this village. A village where, you know, they brought him out. They brought the Sagum out. He pointed out these three young women, and they started attacking him. Fortunately, in this situation, the AG pastor was able to get in. He was able to get him away from the crowd, put him in his truck, and take him away. But even to this day, they can't go back home to their village. That's where, you know, that's where their people are. That they can't go back because they've been branded as, you know, witches, or, well, it's not really witches, but as essentially they've been branded as witches. And so they cannot go back to that community because they were controlling spirits. And again, like I said, it's a little bit complicated, but how can that be in a community where there's an Assemblies of God church right there? I mean, where this was happening, you could throw a rock. It's 50 yards to where the Assemblies of God church is. And they're out there torturing these women because they had the spirit. You know, they were controlling the spirits. It's a lack of discipleship, right? And so that's why we have to continue to go and teach them. And we have to continue to explain to them these things. And so we have to continue to break down those animistic spirits. And I was thinking even just this morning about it. It's a lot like, you know, you look at some of the stuff Paul was talking about in the New Testament. He goes in, he's explaining, and the churches are doing stuff that kind of mixes in their old ways. And so Paul, that's what a lot of the letters are about. He's like, hey, don't be doing that anymore. That's not Christ-like. And so that's our goal, is to essentially go back to PNG and do that. And so, sorry, I'm getting a little bit long-winded on this, but anyway. And so again, I believe it all boils down to a lack of discipleship. People take a little snippet of the gospel, add it to the beliefs they already had in the country, and you end up with what many people believe. And so here I want to give I probably should have put more in here what we had done up to this point, but here is our goals for PNG for going back. And again, thank you for supporting us as we've went before. You know, nothing ever goes quite like you think it did. It would take a while to go into all the stories of the things that happened, but thank you for supporting us. Thank you for taking care of us. So here's the five key areas of ministry focus that we feel like needs to grow in PNG. This is prayer and fasting with our area leadership. His kids are sitting right down here. It's weird being in, because, like, I don't know, people we know. Normally, I go to a church and I don't know anyone, so I can really say anything I want. But here, everybody knows me. So, yeah, anyway, so there's five key areas of ministry focus that we're focusing on. The number one is Bible school teachers. Now, these don't officially have numbers as far as, like, what their importance is. But here's what I'm going to say for PNG. The number one thing we need in PNG right now is Bible school teachers, because we have to get pastors trained to disciple people properly. There's four regions and four regional AOG Bible schools, one national AOG Bible school, and plenty of students for all of them. There's hundreds of students that are willing to go and take the gospel out into hard-to-reach areas, into these remote places. And you know what we've found as we've been there is they're much more suited to do it than we are. You know, local people who already understand the language, they already understand the culture, they're much more suited to go out and do these things. All we have to do is properly train them in a Bible school, and then we have people who are willing to go out and do this work. And we want to work alongside them, but we need people in Bible schools who are willing to go and spend the time to train them properly. You know, right now we have one missionary working with that, Phil and Kim Rojak. They're also from here, so you guys know them. You know, they're one missionary for five Bible schools right now. It doesn't work out. And even that, you know, I don't think they would be upset with me sharing this. You know, they're getting a little bit older. Eventually, they're going to retire. We need people who are willing to come in, work in these Bible schools, raise up these pastors who can then reach not only their nation, but the nation around them. It's exciting talking to these Bible school students because some of them want to be local pastors, some of them want to be evangelists, some of them want to be missionaries to other countries, but we have to have people who can train them. And so that's the number one area we're trying to grow in Papua New Guinea. The second and third area all kind of grouped together is next-gen ministries. So that's youth and children's ministries. I don't have time to fully explain why children's ministries are important, but I think you guys know. I mean, the vast majority of people who come to Christianity worldwide are children. And historically, I think throughout a lot of the Pacific, but especially in PNG, kids' ministry is just not focused on. And right now, it would take a little while to explain the history of things, but we had a good missionary presence for a long time. A generation was saved, and we didn't focus on the kids. And right now, we're kind of really in the process of losing a generation in PNG. I don't know that I want to go that far, but you understand what I'm saying. We don't focus on children's ministry, and I talk to parent after parent in churches, and even a lot of the pastors, and they tell me about how they're mourning over their kids walking away from the church. We have to go. We have to do kids' ministry. And again, it's not that we don't have people to do it. It's we don't have people who know how to do it. And so we need people who are willing to go in and work not only directly with kids' ministries and youth ministries, but who are willing to go in and do that and then work alongside national pastors to train them up and to be the next generation of youth pastors and children's ministry pastors. This is the next generation of Papua New Guinea, and we have to go. We have to reach them. And so all these are, I should have clarified to begin with. I think I had it in my notes too, and I didn't. This is not all things that we're working on. These are all things where we are looking for new missionaries to come in and work alongside us. The work is too great for one person to do. And so we need people who are willing to come alongside us and work with kids ministry and youth ministry. The next area is evangelism and church planting. And again, we have national pastors who are willing to go out and do the church plants, but we're looking for missionaries who are willing to partner with them. People willing to learn from the local church planters and evangelism there, and then begin to spread the knowledge to a new generation of church planters, right? And work alongside them, multiply the work being done. When we talked with our leadership at one point, they said missionaries aren't there to completely do their own work. That's not why we're there to do. We're there to be force multipliers for the work that's going on there. There's already a lot, the church is growing there. There's already a huge work going on in Papua New Guinea with the national church. We need people who are willing to come alongside that, accept what they are doing, and then help them to grow at a rate that they're, multiply. You go up two or three times what they're doing. And the last one, near and dear to our hearts, because it's initially what we want to do, is community development medical. So many of you know, my wife's a nurse practitioner, so she went there initially to do medical. I work with clean water, community development, sanitation, all that kind of stuff. And so many of the issues in the community, they tie back to these things, right? So even like the example I gave earlier with the lady, where they brought in the witch doctor for these people, a lot of it's because they don't understand what's going on. And so if you can come into a community and they can say, hey, my kids are always getting sick, and you can say, well, let me do like a teaching on clean water and sanitation and washing your hands and explain to you why you're getting sick. They don't a lot of times have any concept of bacteria. And so a lot of times it's all, you know, they have their pig house right up the river from where they're getting their water, or their outhouse, or whatever other, you know, various reasons. And so you just do a basic teaching on that, and it helps to break down those animistic beliefs. You're not getting sick because your third neighbor down sent a spirit towards you. You're getting sick because you're not washing your hands, because you're, you know, you're not properly cleaning your meat or what. Anyway, it's, you understand, it's breaking down those beliefs by giving education as to why things happen. And even like the guy who went to the hospital for cancer, just explaining to people what is actually happening so that they don't have to rely on everything being a spirit. And so that's a lot of what we're there to do, is work with that. And so, and then also our vision is eventually to go out and go with local pastors, do health teaching, and then, and like a medical outreach, and then take local Bible school students with us. And so the longer we're in ministry, the more we realize it's all about relationship, right? And so the more time you can spend with someone, the more likely they are to listen to what you have to say. If I just walk up to someone on the street here or anywhere else in the world, and I just start talking about spirituality and God, most people worldwide are going to be like, yeah, you're nuts, all right? But if I can take the time, if I can show them I care about them, you know, you go in with these Bible school students, and so we were only able to do this once, but we would like to do it a lot more. And so we went in where we did a clinic, and then had Bible school students there to pray with them afterwards, right? And so it's a reason to be there. It's a reason to talk to them. It's a reason to show the people you care about them. And so the more you can spend time with them, the more you can show people you care about them, especially like with a lot of these, it was people bringing their kids. If you can show universal worldwide, as far as I know, people love their kids. And if you love their kids, they appreciate it. If you care about people's kids, I don't know that there's anything better you can do to build a relationship with someone than show them that you care about their children. And so you come out, you come in, you do a clinic. Man, I was blanking on the word for a long time. You do a clinic. And that's not good to do when that's one of our main things. I can't think of the word. Anyway, so yeah, you come in, you do a clinic, and you show them you care about them. And once you show them you care about them, they want to know why. Because you, again, it's worldwide. Why? People don't just care about you for no reason. You show about them, you show them you care about them. And once people know that you care about them, they'll listen to you. And you can talk to them, you build, begin to build those relationships. And that's, in a nutshell, what missions is all about. You know, it's, we use a different way. You know, we use medical, other people use other things. But in the end, it's all about building a relationship with people so that eventually we can introduce them into a relationship with Jesus, right? And so that's what it all boils down to. You know, there's a lot of different things listed here. There's a lot of ways that people can go to help, but that's what missions is all about. And I would even say that's what the church here in America should be all about. We have to be all about is introducing new people to Jesus, showing them God's love. You know, we want to help the physical needs of the people with what we do, but realistically, it's secondary, right? Our primary goal is to get them into a relationship with God, right? And so those are the five areas we're looking for people primarily. Again, it's a long-term vision, right? And so the Assemblies of God, Papua New Guinea, it separates its country into five regions. And so our goal is to have one missionary in each one of these five areas in each of the five regions. So 25 total to start with. And I think we can go from there, actually, because I think the need is there. So we want, you know, five Bible school missionaries, five children's ministry missionaries, five youth ministry missionaries, five church planting and evangelism missionaries, and five community development and medical missionaries. We only need four of those because we're one of them. We are back in the States to raise funds, yes, but we're also back in the States to find people to come with us, to come alongside us, and to help us with the work. And again, like I said, it's easy to look at all the needs in PNG. I can assure you, the people there are great. Amy put up that thing, and I don't remember what it actually links to. Can you tell me what that links to? Oh, yeah. If you feel called to go, scan this. Sorry, this is our first sermon back in the States, and I should have known that, but I didn't. So, yeah, I mean, if you feel called to go, if you feel an interest towards it, scan that tag, talk to us after the service. I mean, this is our home church, so we'll be around. Or just ask someone. My parents are right over there. You can ask for my number. My sister's somewhere here. Everybody here knows who we are. So just ask someone if you want to talk to us, and we'd be love to get together with you for lunch or whatever. Anyway, so for now, I'll move on from PNG. And so I want to talk to you a little bit about what God has been kind of been working on in my life lately. And so we talked a little bit about, you know, what's happened so far. And you always go in your first term, you know, you got ideas of what you think's going to happen. And all veteran people are like, yeah, you're not going to accomplish that much the first 3 years. You're like, no, I can do that. I'll get all this stuff done. And you have an idea of what you think's going to happen. And then it doesn't, right? And so I'm not trying to say we didn't do anything. We worked hard. We did the best that we could. But certain things are just, and especially in the islands. I look at Ani Sun back there, and I'm like, Ani Sun, she doesn't have that problem. She plants a church like every 2 months in the islands. And so she's like, if you want to talk to someone, she's awesome. She is our favorite. And when we say Auntie Sun, she truly is. She loves every one of us in the Pacific, loves our kids. She's the best. But for most people, other than Auntie Sun, things take a long time in the Pacific to happen. And so, you know, to build the relationships, everything's about relationship. And so you just don't accomplish everything you think you should be able to accomplish while we're there. And as I've been reading through my Bible, even like the last, I mean, I would say a year, God's really been putting it on my heart as I read various stories. And I see that we really, in the Bible, we're just getting small glimpses of what's happening, right? We're not getting a full story of everything. It's like any history book. You're just getting the highlights and the lows, right? And it can often be decades or even centuries that you're seeing that time frame come over. So we see a lot of examples in this in the Bible. I won't go into all of them, obviously. The first one I thought about was Joseph. You know, in the Bible, Joseph gets just about more real estate than anyone, right? And his entire life starts in Genesis 37, ends with chapter 50. That's only 13 chapters. And there's other stuff mixed in there, so he's not even getting a full 13 chapters. Yet it's his entire life. Joseph lived to be 110 years old, and we can read the whole story in 13 chapters in an easy afternoon, an hour or two. Abraham's much the same way. His story starts in Genesis 12, finishes in chapter 25. Again, 13 chapters. Abraham lived to be 175 years old. Why does it matter? Let's look at a few stories from Abraham and Joseph this morning, and I want to show you the point that I'm trying to get to. We'll start with the story of Abraham. So let's look at Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 5. Genesis chapter 12, verse 1 through 5. Okay. All right, I think we have it on screen. Perfect. Yeah. Okay, so chapter 12, verse 1, it says, "The Lord said to Abraham, 'Go from your land, your relatives, and your father's house, the land that I will show you. I'll make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse anyone who treats you with contempt, and all the people on the earth will be blessed through you.' So Abraham went as the Lord told him, and Lot went with him. Abraham was 75 years old when he left Haran. He took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, all the possessions they'd accumulated, and the people they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan." Okay, so this is our introduction to Abraham in the Bible, right? God promises to make him into a great nation. But when we first are introduced to Abraham in the Bible, he's already 75 years old. He's no spring chicken, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, they obviously lived a little bit longer in that time. So I don't know that he was biologically past childbearing years, but he was old, you know? And so he was more than likely, if not at the end of childbearing years, past childbearing years. And so, but God promises to make him into a great nation. And I'm not going to tell the whole story of Abraham. We don't have time for that because I know this is a good Bible-believing church. I know that you guys know the story. If you don't, just read it. It's 13 chapters. Doesn't take that long. But I do want to go over some key points on the story and the timing of it. Okay, and so let's jump ahead. Oh, wait. So in verse 1, God says to go. Verse 4, Abraham went. So Abraham did what God asked him to do. And so, again, you do what, I can feel this as I as we go overseas. God asks us to do something, and then I don't know if you want to say you expect something in return, but that's kind of how it feels like. And so I shouldn't have said it like that. Anyway, that was a bad representation. But yeah, so anyway, Abraham, God told Abraham to go, and he went. Okay? As the Lord had told him. So Abraham trusted the Lord, did what he said. Let's skip ahead a little to chapter 15. Chapter 15. I did not put what verse 1. Okay. Chapter 15, verse 1. Okay, and it starts, says, after these events, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abraham. I am your shield. Your reward will be very great. But Abraham said, Lord God, what can you give me since I'm childless and the heir of my house? Heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus. Abraham continued, look, you have given me no offspring, so a slave born in my house will be my heir. Now the word of the Lord came to him. This one will be your heir. This one will not be your heir. Instead, one who comes from your own body will be your heir. He took him outside and said, look at the sky and count the stars if you're able to count them. Then he said to him, your offspring will be that numerous. Verse 6 says, Abraham believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. So some time has passed since chapter 12, right? We don't know exactly how much time. Most scholars estimate somewhere between 5 to 10 years have actually taken place. And, you know, again, I don't know that for sure. We don't have any way of knowing. We just know that several years had passed from what we learned in chapters 12 through 15. Now, in the grand scheme of things, again, we read this in just a few chapters, but to Abraham, this is not, you know, an easy afternoon. This is years of his life that are taking place. And again, the story started when he was 75 years old. God asked him to do something. If he did, God said he would make him into a great nation. That's exciting, right? I do what God asked me to do. He will turn me into a great nation. But he's already 75 years old, originally without kids. Now, we don't know exactly how old he is, you know, probably 80, 85. Still nothing has happened. He's gone on the path that God asked him to go. Obviously, he made some mistakes. Again, I won't go into all the details, but he had went where God asked him to go, and more years had passed with no kids. So I do understand his frustration. I'm not saying what he did is right. I'm just saying I understand his frustration. But God says to Abraham, don't be afraid. I'm your shield. Your reward will be very great. Abraham isn't seeing all that God's working in the background, right? All he's seeing is what's in front of him. All he sees is the facts that are in front of him. And he replies, Lord God, what can you give me since I am childless and the heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus? Abraham continued, look, you have given me no offspring, so a slave born in my house will be my heir. Okay, so he's a bit aggravated. Again, I understand. And God said he would make him into a great nation if he did what he said. Abraham did what God said. Now he's upset, asking God, what's going on? So God reassures him in verse 5. And it says, God said, look at the sky and count the stars if you are able to count them. Then he said to him, your offspring will be that numerous. Abraham believed the Lord. It was credited to him as righteousness. All right? So God doubles down on his promise. God doesn't need to do that, right? Because if God said it's going to happen, it's going to happen. But again, God understands us, and he knew that probably Abraham needed that encouragement at that time. If God says he's going to do something, you can take it to the bank. He's going to do it. So we can stand strong on the promise of God, knowing that he's faithful to do what he has said he will do, just sometimes not in the time frame that we would prefer, right? So God affirms his covenant with Abraham, yet the story goes on from there and no kids, right? And so let's look at Genesis chapter 18, verses 1 through 15. Okay, 18 verses 1. It says, the Lord appeared to Abraham at the oaks of Mamre, I guess, while he was sitting at the entrance of his tent during the heat of the day. He looked up and he saw three men standing near him. When he saw them, he ran from the entrance entrance of the tent to meet them, bowed to the ground, and said, Lord, my Lord, I have found favor with you. Please do not go on past your servant. Let a little water be brought that you may wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree. I will bring a bit of bread so that you may strengthen yourselves. Strengthen yourselves. This is why you have passed your servant's way. Later you can continue on. Yes, they replied. Do as you have said. So Abraham hurried into the tent and said to Sarah, "Quick, knead 3 measures of fine flour, make bread." Abraham ran to the herd, got a tender choice calf. He gave it to a young man who hurried to prepare it. Then Abraham took curds and milk, as well as the calf that he had prepared, set them before the men. He served them as they ate under the tree. And here's where really I want to focus in on what's happening. It says, "Where is your wife, Sarah?" they asked him. "There in the tent," he answered. The Lord said, "I will certainly come back to you in about a year's time, and your wife Sarah will have a son." Now Sarah was listening at the entrance of the tent behind him. Abraham and Sarah were old and getting on in years. Sarah had passed the age of childbearing, so we don't know for sure that she was before, but we can say for sure she is now, right? So she laughed to herself, "After I'm worn out and my Lord is old, will I have delight?" But the Lord asked Abraham, "Why does Sarah laugh, saying, 'Can I really have a baby when I'm old?' Is anything impossible for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will come back to you in about a year, and she will have a son." Sarah denied it. "I did not laugh," she said, because she was afraid. But he replied, "No, you did laugh." And so we don't find it out here, but we'll find out later at this point. Abraham was 99, and since Sarah was 10 years younger, she was 89 years old. She was well beyond childbearing years. We know that for sure. The initial promise was made when they were 75, or when he was 75. So 24 years have passed from the time that Abraham first heard from God till this point, and still no kids, right? I can understand, Sarah. You know, again, you read these stories when you're younger, and you're like, "Oh, why would she laugh?" Obviously, God said it was going to happen. It was happening. It's like, well, you look at the time frame, and 24 years had gone by, and it didn't happen. And so I can understand her doubt in this time, right? When God made the initial promise, they were already past childbearing years. Okay. Yet we see in chapter 21, verse 1 through 7, what happened. Chapter 21, verse 1, it says, "The Lord came to Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah what he had promised. Sarah became pregnant and bore a son to Abraham in his old age at the appointed time God had told him. Abraham named his son who was born to him, the one Sarah bore to him, Isaac. When his son Isaac was 8 days old, Abraham circumcised him as God had commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Sarah said, 'God has made me laugh, and everyone who hears will laugh with me.' She also said, 'Who would have told Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne a son to him in his old age.'" Abraham was 100 years old when his firstborn son was born, Isaac. 25 years passed from the time the promise was given till the time that God made it happen. 25 years. But God had a plan the entire time, right? He knew what he was doing. Even though Sarah and Abraham's faith may have waned, God still knew what he was doing. He still had a plan and a purpose in line for all of this, right? And that kind of leads me to my main focus today, which is God's ways are better than our ways. His thoughts are bigger and better than our thoughts. You and I read the story of Abraham again in just a few hours, but it was 25 years. I keep saying that, but it still just sticks in my mind. 25 years he waited for God's promise to come true, right? And even then, he really never saw the true fruits of the covenant that God made with him, right? Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac was born. He lived to be 175, so he had more kids, and I'm sure at that point Isaac had kids. But God had said to him, "Your descendants will be as numerous as the stars in the sky." Abraham never saw that truly come to fruition. But God's ways are not our ways. His thoughts are not our thoughts. Time is not the same to God as it is to us. And he's working things together that we can't even fathom in a timing that we can't even fathom. We have just a glimpse of what we can see around us, right? We see, what's happening to us right here and right now. We don't even, in this world, in this generation, we can see more of what's happening in the entire world around us than anyone else in the history of the world. We can know what's going on in Papua New Guinea from here. We can know what's going on in Indonesia. We can know what's going on all over the world. But even that, we're just getting little snippets of news. We don't understand everything that's happening going on. But God does. God knows everything that's happening everywhere with everyone all at the same time. and he's working them all together for his glory all at the same time. Not only is he working with everyone that's here right now, he's known for thousands of years, everyone who ever has existed, everyone who's existing now, everyone who ever will exist, and he's working everything together in this giant tapestry that we will never truly fully understand until we get to heaven. God's timing is not our timing. His thoughts are not our thoughts. We just, you know, all we can really see is what's on the surface. I even look at this building as an example. You know, we just see what's on the surface. We see a little sheetrock. We see a little, you know, we see a light fixture. We don't see all the beams inside and all the beams in the ceiling and all the, you know, this is home. So I've been in all the ceilings. I've seen the beams, but even I don't understand everything that's up there, you know? And so, but the designer did, right? The architect and the engineer that worked it all out, they figured all these things out in advance so that as the building went up, the beams would support the structure of the church. The wires were big enough so that the building wouldn't catch fire. All these things the designer had to think about beforehand. And as it was being built, the builders were just working out his plan, right? Sorry, I'm getting off my notes a little bit here, but so yeah, if you know, you just imagine that, right? You see all these thousands of parts in a building, and it's hard to even comprehend all those. And you see that then multiplied across the entire universe, and not only across the entire universe now, but across the entire universe for all eternity. And God has worked it all together into his plan and sees it and sees what's happening. And so I get peace in that, knowing that God is in control, knowing that he's there. It's not our timing, it's his timing. You know, we have the benefit of looking through the Old Testament through the lens of history. We have to remember these stories took place over lifetimes and sometimes generations before the promise of God's plan came true. The story of the Old Testament, story of Joseph in the Old Testament starts with him having a vision by God that he would one day rule over his father and his brothers. Did it happen right away? No. Joseph, he was sold as a slave. He was falsely accused. He was falsely imprisoned. His friends forgot about him. But in the end, what God said would happen, happened. And not only what he said would happen happened, God used Joseph in ways that he could have never even imagined. You know, he not only did he save his entire family from starvation, but entire ethnic groups of people from, you know, Egypt and all the groups around, many of them would have died off if it hadn't been for Joseph. Yeah, he didn't know that when he was sitting in the well, right? God's plan is greater than ours. His thoughts are greater than our thoughts. So how does this help us to know that? Well, it helps us to persevere, right? Why? Because we know God is in control. When we know that God's plan is so great and all-encompassing, we can go through extended hard times knowing that God is in control, just like the people in the Old Testament, right? We can have the benefit now of looking back and seeing what happened and see that God was faithful to them. And you know what I can tell you? If he was faithful to them, God didn't change. He's going to be faithful to you and me, right? Now, we may not ever see it, and it may not even seem like it at the time, right? You think Abraham wanted to wait 100 years for his firstborn son? Probably not. I bet if you asked him and Sarah what they wanted, they would have been like, yeah, maybe 25. That'd be a great time for a first kid, you know? Well, 75 years later, it's like, well, you know, God, you could have done this a little sooner. And I find myself feeling that too sometimes. I bet if you asked Joseph when he was sitting in the bottom of the well, if he wanted out, he would have said yes. You see what I'm saying? It's, we don't understand the plan that God has, but we can have perseverance in knowing that he does have a plan, that it's there, that it's in place, and that even if we never see the results of it, he's working it for his glory, right? You know, it also gives us hope. You know, hope knowing that God is in control, that no matter the circumstances, he is using it for his glory, that God can take junk and turn it into something of great value. God doesn't waste anything, especially pain. One of my favorite pastors, Brian Jarrett, he says God should have another name in the Bible. Now, again, this isn't in the Bible. This is his saying. But he said it, God should be named Jehovah Frugal because he doesn't waste anything. God's not wasting that time. It's easy for us to look at things and say, like, God, we should have been three steps down the road by now. Why are we still here? But God's like, listen, I got this. It's all in my plan. I know what I'm doing, right? God knows what's going on, even when it doesn't make sense to us. And that gives me hope in knowing that. And so I thought a lot about what to do to close out this sermon. And I was trying, just thinking of what to do, because I didn't really know what to do. And one of these, I started trying to think of a story that, and I'm not sure that's the best story, because it could be seen as negative, it could be seen as positive, depends on how you look at it. And so this is actually not on Papua New Guinea. It was in the islands of Vanuatu. So we got Missionary Son was back there. This is probably the only church service I'll be in the United States where there's three people who have been to this place. And so it was on the story is from the island of Pentecost. And so I want to keep the story short, but you might think with a name like the island of Pentecost that it's a Christian island. Well, that's not the case. There were Christian explorers that named all the islands as they were going through. Pentecost Island is not, Pentecostal or Christian for the most part. It's slowly changing, especially when this story took place. It's changing now. Great things are going on with the missionaries that are there. You should have them in sometime and ask them about it, because it's exciting what's going on now. But this wasn't then. And so this is Pentecost back. I don't know exactly the years this took place, but when we were there was, 5 years ago when we were in Vanuatu roughly. I'm not sure exactly when. Anyway, so what you do is you do a cultural immersion. You go live in a village. You go, I went with the men when they went out to do whatever they were going to do. Amy went with the women when they went out to do. The idea is just to learn the language and culture. And so we were in this one village. It was a Christian village on the coast. And so they had a little plaque in memory of a missionary. And so I asked the local pastor there, what's the story with that, right? And so he starts telling me about what happened. And I lost a lot of pictures from Vanuatu, so I don't have the pastor's name. But I'll never forget the story. And so he starts telling me the story of the first missionaries that came to his village in Vanuatu. And so Vanuatu, like a lot of the Pacific Island countries, there were, it wasn't quite slave trade. There was like indentured servitude where people from Australia and New Zealand, they would go into the islands, pick people up, take them to Australia to work for a certain specified period of time, then they would bring them back to the islands. And so that's what happened to these two guys, right? So a lot of terrible things came from that. But also some good things came from that as well. And so this is one of the good things came from. So two of these guys, when they were there for that time in Australia, they got saved. And then they got called into missions, right? And so they knew they were going to go back to their home country, and they felt like they were supposed to go to the island of Pentecost. And so these guys, they finish their time in Australia. They get some, probably very basic theological trainings, just enough to go back, and you don't have to have a master's in divinity to spread the word, right? And so they get enough training where they feel like they can go back to their island. They go back to get dropped off in Vanuatu on another island, and then they eventually make their way to the island of Pentecost, to the village of Sorampatur, right? Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so they make their way to the village of Rampatur. And so that's where we ended up doing our immersion. And so these two guys made it to Rampatur. And there, as in many places in the islands at this time, they were cannibals. And they did not appreciate people coming in with a new gospel, with a new, new things. And so the chief in the village made the decision they were going to kill and eat these guys. And so one of them was able to convince the chief, hey, kill me. Eat me, but let this other guy stay. And so, I don't know the details of the conversation, but that's what happened. They killed and ate one missionary, but they let the other one stay. And through time, that man was able to spread the gospel to that village. And eventually they all turned to Christ. And right now, this, like, to this day, the man who was telling me that story, I think Amy might, so that's Pastor Stewart there on the left. And I can't remember what relation he is, but I think it was the great-great-grandson of the missionary who was allowed to live. And he's the pastor in that village to this day. And not only from the sacrifice of that missionary did that one village get saved, but even to this day, as the gospel is exploding on that island right now, Andy's son might be able to give us some numbers on that, but it went from no AG churches, no AG presence to, like I said, I don't want to put a number on it, but it's several now. But when they all come in, this is still the home base. This village where this missionary gave his life for his brother so that his brother could spread the gospel, all the missionaries, they still come in, they base there, and they go out from there. Not only did his life save the people that he was around then, it saved generation after generation in that village, and then it saved generation after generation as they go out from that village, as they reach those around them. And even to this day, the things that are happening there, it's all because of his legacy. But he didn't know that at the time, right? You know, we're, I think, about 150 years in the future from when that happened. There's no way he could have known. In the short-term view, it looked like he died for nothing. When he died, he didn't know it was going to happen. But God did. He had a plan for it the entire time. He had a plan for everything that was going to happen. And that gives me peace, right? Knowing that God is in control. You know, I look at our own story, and it's only been 3 years, right? I look at Abraham's story. He was 25. Joseph was in prison for like 17. It's only been 3 years for us. And I struggle. And I'm like, man, God, why hasn't this happened yet? We came for this. You told us to come for this. Why is it not happening? And then I read the stories, and I'm like, you got this, right? You know what's going on. You have a plan. It gives me hope looking at these stories. It can seem like at times things aren't happening, but I know God is working in the background. It's his plan and not mine. There's so many things where I would want them to happen right now. But if they happen right now, I wouldn't be ready. You know, I might not be ready for them. If you'd ask me, so like, again, this church is a little different than most. You kind of know our mission story. You know, we've only been in PNG 3 years, but in missions total, what are we like at 8 or 9 now since we felt called? Something like that. I keep looking up to my wife, but oh, she's at now. She's down there. 10 years. Yeah, 10 years. We're at 10 years now. If you'd asked me 10 years ago when God first called me missions, are you ready to go to Papua New Guinea? I'd be like, yeah, I'm here. I'm ready for it. I know what I'm doing. Let's get going. I mean, we wouldn't have survived. I look back at it now. I'm like, God had a plan for each of those little delays that were in the process, right? He grew us in this way here. He grew us in this way here. And I didn't understand it at the time, but God did, right? He knew the plan, he knew the purpose, he knew what was going on. So we just want to end it right there. You know, you want to come up to you? Sorry, I ran a little bit later than I planned, but we'll just have like a very brief altar service. And I want to invite anyone to come up. You know, it doesn't matter what, I think a lot of times people can look at missionaries like they're more different, and they hear some of the stories we talk about, different stuff that's happening, and they're like, well, mine's not like that, so why would I come forward? That's not a big deal. God sees it all, right? He sees all the details from little to big. He sees your struggle. He sees your pain. He sees your heartache. And so right now, you know, if you guys are struggling today, I just want to pray with you. He said, y'all are my family. I just want to pray with you guys. So if things are happening right now, and, you know, I'll give a little bit of another caveat, not caveat, but a little thing on the altar time today too. But, man, if you're struggling today, you don't know what's going on or what why God's doing things like they are. You don't understand what's going on around you. I get it. Man, come and pray with us. We'll pray that, and I even struggle because I don't necessarily want to say that pray that God will take the things away, because a lot of times he's using those things to grow us. But pray that we would have an understanding of what's happening. Pray that we would have a peace in knowing that God is with us. Pray that we would persevere through it and get to where God has for us, because there's things, sometimes things come and it breaks us down and we give up before we get to where God has for us to go.